Hello, and welcome back to Tales from Wisteria Lane, the podcast where we give you a fair view of all things Desperate Housewives. We are the boyfriends. I'm Billy Ray.
And I'm Joel.
And in today's episode, we're going to be discussing Season 7, Episode 9, Pleasant Little Kingdom.
Yes.
So, do you have any trivia before we get started?
Always and forever, Alyssa Edwards. So, this episode aired on the 5th of December, 2010. It was directed by Arlene Sanford and written by David Flabott. So, the scene where Susan knocks on Renee's door to give her a misdelivered birthday card, Renee is crying to the song One Less Bell to Answer, sung by Vanessa Williams, which means that in the Desperate Housewives universe, Vanessa Williams exists.
And Renee's a big fan.
She's a fan of herself, of course. There's no surprise there. Now, apparently, even though I didn't get a chance to go back to the episode to double check this, Paul Young breaks the fourth wall in the last seconds of the episode.
Yeah, he does. He walks out of one of the houses after the big neighbor conference thing, and he stares at the camera and smiles.
Oh.
He's looking at us and saying, my devious plan is coming to fruition.
Yes. So the episode title comes from a song that was cut from the Stephen Sondheim musical Follies. Okay, so see, immigration is a big topic in this episode, and it's actually, well, for Gabby's storyline anyway, and it's actually quite a big topic in life in general. So I did a little bit of research for immigration for the UK, because that's where we're based. So despite the UK's proud history of supporting refugees, the British government has recently made big changes to the asylum system, and under the Illegal Migration Act, those who arrive in an unofficial way, such as by crossing the Channel, which is the body of water between the United Kingdom and France, for those that may not know, will no longer be given protection, but will instead face detention and the risk of destitution. This is alongside other planned changes, including outsourcing the UK's asylum obligations to other countries like Rwanda. Obviously, it has been recently announced that the Supreme Court have rejected the Conservative government's plans to send all illegal immigrants, asylum seekers, refugees, anyone that comes over to the country, essentially, that is not a member of the country, to Rwanda, as they have deemed it unlawful, essentially. Now, the Conservative government are still going to be wandering around and trying to find a way to actually get away with it, but...
Yeah.
For the time being, that's been put on hold.
Thank God for that decision.
As of last year, around 1 in 77 of the world's population has been forced to flee their home. That's around 103 million people. Most people, so 74%, have fled to neighbouring or developing countries. So the 1951 Refugee Convention, which was created by the UN after World War I, protects people fleeing persecution, and is quoted as saying, owing to a well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group or political opinion, and is unable to, or owing to such fear, is unwilling to avail himself of the protection of that country. So essentially what that means is there is an internationally recognized right under these circumstances to seek safety elsewhere. And since then, sexual orientation has been included in that as well, sexual orientation and identity. So there's only a tiny portion of the UK population that are actually refugees, and the number of refugees and people seeking asylum tends to go up or down depending, obviously, on what happens in the world.
Mm-hmm.
The UK has not been flooded by refugees looking for safety, despite what the media may say, and out of the 6.7 million Syrian refugees globally, a staggering 4.6 million are being hosted by its neighbours, Turkey and Lebanon. In addition, asylum claims based on sexual orientation are extremely low, and in 2022, just 2% of asylum claims in the UK included sexual orientation as a part of their basis.
If you asked any Tories in our parents' generation after they've read a newspaper, they would think that 80% of the UK is just asylum seekers or migrants or something stealing their jobs, though.
Stealing jobs and claiming benefits.
Yeah, claiming benefits, getting free houses when we have to work for our houses, all this rubbish.
Yeah. So that's all of that information was from the Red Cross, which are the UK's leading migrant charity, essentially helping out the migrants. So obviously, if you want more information, you can go onto the Red Cross and have a look. And I do recommend it. It is quite eye-opening. And it's good to sort of get yourselves educated on this topic, because you can't always trust everything that the media are saying, because it is fear-mongering an awful lot of the time.
They're run by Tories. You can't trust the media.
No.
Absolutely not.
Anyway, that stuff done. On this day, or in this week, 23 students and a teacher are released after being taken hostage for 5 hours by an armed 15-year-old student who then shot and injured himself at Marionette High School in the town of Marionette, Wisconsin.
Oh, God.
Yeah. The United Kingdom continues to face blizzard conditions with many schools closed, long queues on the M8 motorway in Scotland, and Edinburgh Airport closing. That was that snowy, shut down the whole country.
Yeah.
I remember that. Fantasia and Fantasia 2000 are released on Blu-ray and DVD.
Lovely.
The easing of Israel's blockade of Gaza 6 months ago has led to little improvement for people living there. A report by 21 Aid and Right agencies says Israeli officials say that the claims are biased and distorted.
Mm-hmm.
I just added that in there because at the moment it feels like it's imitating itself again, where it's come back up in the media, Gaza and Israel.
Well, history doesn't repeat, but it certainly rhymes.
Yep. Oh, I like that phrase. That's a good phrase. United States Secretary of Defense Robert Gates urges the United States Senate to abolish Don't Ask, Don't Tell for gays and lesbians serving in the U.S. military and releases a report showing that ending the policy would have little impact.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. Israel reveals plans to build 625 more homes in the Palestinian territories close to East Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
A U.S. Army medic received 9 months in jail after pleading guilty to shooting 2 unarmed Afghan farmers for no apparent reason.
He got 9 months.
Yep. One of the 12 American soldiers admits to acting on orders and shooting unarmed Afghan farmers, and he is sentenced to 9 months imprisonment and demotion, but he's allowed to stay in the military.
Okay, that makes sense. Right, mm-hmm. Cool.
Anyway, so that was a brief overview of what happened in the week. So the number one song for the US was Raise Your Glass by Pink.
Woo!
And the number one song in the UK was Heroes by the X Factor finalists of 2010.
I think I prefer the Pink song.
The number one movie in the box office in the US at the moment was Tangled.
Mm-hmm.
And the number one film in the box office for the UK was Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1.
Oh yeah, Deathly Hallows Part 1.
Yeah.
I didn't enjoy that one.
And that's all the trivia.
So, on with the episode then.
Yes.
So previously, Renee and Tom flirted with each other whilst discussing their past affair. Bree's dinner blew up with Keith's parents deciding to divorce. Hector got arrested as an illegal immigrant, leading to Gabby worrying about losing Grace. And apparently Paul's plan was set in motion. At least that's what Mary Alice says. What that means, we'll find out. We're starting this episode with Bree. Bree and Keith are out for dinner and she meets him at his place. He answers in his suit, looking all handsome, and he really impresses Bree. This is a huge improvement on the whole jeans and tartan shirt for dinner thing that he was going for before, by the way.
Yeah, Bree really seems to have changed him now. She's got him into her kind of expectation of what to wear.
He goes to his room to grab something, and Bree sees Keith's dad walking around in his dressing gown. Apparently, he's just woken up. He seems depressed, so Bree tells him that he's still handsome for 50 plus and that he needs to have a shower, get dressed and leave the flat, you know, go touch some grass. Keith, in the other room, puts an engagement ring in his pocket and joins Bree, who tells Keith that she's invited his dad to dinner with them.
I wouldn't be happy about this. I'd be quite upset, actually.
Where's the etiquette?
Yeah, it's just, if this was you, I get it, don't get me wrong, and I know your parents listen to this podcast, so hi, but I would not be too happy if you'd invited your parents to dinner without actually discussing it with me first.
No, we don't do that. We don't do that.
Also, the day off as well, like, we're literally about to go out for dinner, and then you think you can just call the restaurant and be like, yeah, can you add a third, please? And, like, it's just, the dad's kind of giving this weird vibe around Bree now.
Well, what is wrong with Bree? Does she not think it would be weird for Keith to have his dad at a dinner with his girlfriend?
With his girlfriend, just weird. I think it's because Bree and Keith's dad, Richard, that's his name, are the same age. Bree probably has a hard time of seeing him as a dad and sees him as just another person because they're the same age.
God,
but
yeah, maybe.
So that it could be that Bree sort of has that disassociation with him.
So later, we can assume a couple of days at this point. Bree and Keith are at a restaurant, and this time without Keith's dad. Sadly, we did not get to see the previous dinner and all of the awkwardness that unfolded with that. So Bree goes to get drinks as Keith checks them in, and he talks to the receptionist lady about what food they can serve the engagement ring in. While that's happening, Bree runs into an old friend at the bar, Tracy Miller, and she tells Bree about her recent divorce and how happy she is. Keith then comes over, and Tracy mistakenly thinks that this is Andrew, which is embarrassing.
It is, but nobody seems awkward when she says it.
No, but maybe she's just getting used to the fact that people see that she's dating a younger man. But
maybe.
Anyway, Bree tells her that this is her boyfriend Keith, and Tracy says that they're clearly both doing pretty great.
And then Bree gives her a little wink.
Yeah.
Before she walks off, Bree like winks to her, and then they go to their table.
So Brief and... Brief?
Brief.
No, that's not going to work.
That's their couple name.
It's not going to work. So Bree and Keith are at the table when Keith's dad just surprisingly shows up.
Yeah, and guilt trips them into including him.
Yeah, he says that he's going to order food to take back to the flat and probably just eat over the sink, clearly wanting Bree to invite him to stay, but notice that he is wearing, you know, the suit and everything. Keith tries to stop this, but Bree does invite him to join them. Keith is annoyed about this and says that he'll get off his ass and find someone else to be with in his own time, but Bree sees Tracy across the room and decides to invite her over too, possibly thinking they'll hit it off.
You're trying to pair up Tracy and Richard.
Terrible idea. Terrible. Keith's dad and Tracy do not hit it off as they disagree about the military and the existence of God. So Keith and Bree have an aside. He tells her that he needs them to leave so that he can have a private and important conversation with her when Tracy shouts to the room asking if anyone ordered the shrimp cocktail with a tiny engagement ring inside, much to Keith's absolute horror and embarrassment.
Why would you want engagement ring in food?
I wouldn't. I wouldn't want it in food. I wouldn't want it in a drink. I don't care about any of this bullshit romanticism on films and TV.
Don't put my engagement ring in anything that can just get it dirty. That's weird. That's what the box is for.
Yes. So he grabs the ring and tells Bree to forget that she saw this before saying that the whole night is ruined and doing a walk-off.
Yeah, and he like says shame on you to all of the people.
Yeah,
shame, shame on you.
So Bree shows up at Keith's place and his dad opens the door. Unfortunately, Keith is out somewhere, so she goes in to wait for him and talks to Keith's dad about the almost proposal.
Mm.
He asks what she would have said, but she is unsure. And then he says that he could never have seen Bree with Keith and sees her more with someone her own age and with the same sort of values. And he's clearly just flirting and it's gross.
It makes me uncomfortable. Like, it's none of Richard's business. Like, what were you going to say? Oh, I don't really see you with my son.
Mm. But she says that she loves his son before deciding to leave. And she handles it all very gracefully, I must say.
She does.
She doesn't make it weirder. Now let's move on to a more funny story, which is Susan and Renee, who team up this episode for their story.
They do, yes.
So Susan goes over to Renee's to find her wailing on the sofa with music on by Vanessa Williams.
Yep, Renee is listening to herself.
Yeah. So Susan, clearly noticing how awkward this is, says, I really have to start knocking, and decides to sneak out and knock loudly on the door. This pretending that she never just walked into this woman's house.
This isn't the first time this episode that Susan walks in without knocking, but we'll get to the first official time that Susan does that, but that's where that comes from. But
and she used to do this to Angie in the last season at the end as well.
Yeah, she did.
She has a horrible habit of this.
Of just walking into people's... I mean, they all do it, really.
So Renee makes herself a little bit more presentable and answers the door with an exasperated, what? Susan then brings up that it's Renee's birthday and asks if they can go out together and drink enough booze to wash away the pain, which Renee agrees to, mainly to shut her up.
Why do you assume I'm in pain?
I meant for my pain. I can see why Renee finds Susan annoying, and I do wholeheartedly relate to Renee, and I think it is hilarious. But I also think it's very sweet that Susan's trying, because she hasn't really had all that much luck with the neighbours of the season, especially in the last season when Angie just hated her.
Yeah, she didn't. I don't remember Susan and Betty. Oh, well, Betty was teaching Susan how to play piano, wasn't she?
Yeah, but she basically slagged her off.
Yeah, that was that.
And then she was like, aren't you going to say goodbye to Susan? And Angie just says, we're not really that close. And then she slams the door in her face at the end.
Yeah.
Susan is having dinner with Renee and talking about how she can make a chicken stretch into four different meals throughout the week, which, I mean, great.
I mean, thank God for Susan being here to teach us how the other half live. Like, whatever would we do without her advice on how not to waste food?
But Renee can't relate.
No.
Renee is unimpressed and more bored by how long the story went on for.
Into a 45-minute conversation.
She asks Susan who her competition is, and she said, because she said that she was the fun one on the lane. And Susan says that she saw Renee crying and she just wanted to cheer her up.
Mm.
She mistakenly thinks that she was sad about being alone, but Renee shows that she has absolutely no trouble getting a man with a very fun demonstration.
Yeah, with a dude that's at dinner with his girlfriend who's in the toilet, and then he's like, oh yeah, I'll date you, but keep it quiet. Like, I'm seeing someone else. So just, yeah. Oh, dude.
She just turns to any man she sees and goes, would you date me?
Yeah, like the first man she sees. And then as he's halfway through saying, yes, but keep it quiet, she just turns back to Susan like he doesn't exist. And she's like, see?
And then she says that she was crying over the one that got away, the man who really mattered from her past.
Yeah.
Apparently, there was someone else in the picture, though. Susan comforts her and talks about the setbacks that her and Mike have had and tells her not to give up, which cheers up Renee, and she says that Susan isn't the fun one, she's the smart one.
Lynette is fuming right now.
Yeah, because isn't Lynette supposed to be the smart one?
Lynette's the smart one, Gabby's the fashionable one, Bree's the good cook, Susan's Susan.
Yeah, but yeah, they've bonded now.
Yes, they have.
It's very sweet. So Susan and Renee are back home at Renee's place, that is, and Susan helps her in as Renee is drunk as anything. And we have a clip.
And that's how you get out of paying for a taxi.
Well, we weren't in a taxi, we were in my car. But now I know why you showed me your boobs. Okay, that's a lot of stairs. How does sleeping on the couch sound?
You know something? I told them that you were this mousy little loser.
Actually, you told that to me.
Oh, I'm sorry. Because I really like you now. You're nice. Much nicer than that Susan.
Okay. Nighty-night.
Much nicer than that Susan.
So the lady's clearly struggling with her confused feelings of only just liking Susan, but recently not liking Susan. And those are like clashing in her drunk
they
mind.
Seem to be, yeah, clashing for her.
So Susan asks if Renee's going to be okay. And Renee says that she thought she'd be okay living on the same street as him.
It's him.
But it's very hard. Susan questions this and then Renee drunkenly says that Tom Scarvo is the love of her life before falling asleep.
And who can blame her? We already know she's had sex with Tom, and the information we're about to get on Tom Scarvo in this episode,
yeah.
I don't blame her for remembering a session with Tom.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going to say.
So with that in mind, let's move on to Lynette's story. Mary Alice opens the episode talking about things that parents must remember, such as which toys and vegetables their kids like, but they always forget how quickly their kids grow up. Lynette is emotional about the kids growing up so fast, but Tom is looking forward to being alone with Lynette and having lots and lots of sex. But they might be a bit too old to fulfill most of Tom's fantasy here, as he's going to want a lot and he probably won't be able to give a lot by that point because they're already kind of old. So by the time that page is old enough to move out.
Right. And you can't win with Lynette. She cries when her kids are all grown up. She cries when she finds out that she's pregnant. Like, bitch, pick a lane.
That's parents for you.
Right.
But anyway, they get to get naked on the floor in the nursery. But unfortunately, this is when Susan decides to walk in and catches them in the act before doing a runoff.
Oh, tell her it's dead.
Yeah, which is, in chronological order, the first instance of Susan not knocking before entering.
Yeah. My main question for this opening is, who left a stalk of broccoli on the Scarvo stairs?
I don't know, why?
Because there's a stalk of broccoli on the Scarvo stairs, like in that beginning when Mary Alice is talking about whatever it was she was talking about. And then we see a shot of Lynette going up her stairs. There's a stalk of broccoli on one of the stairs. And Paige is only a baby, so it wouldn't have been her, because why is she playing with the stalk of broccoli? And the rest of the kids are surely old enough to not be randomly playing with vegetables, like the Scarvo household is hosting the next episode of VeggieTales.
So it couldn't be a toy?
No.
Well, maybe they thought, let her play with that, and then if she wants to eat it, at least it's healthy.
Yeah, true.
So Susan enters the house, eyes covered, and Lynette brings up that they haven't made eye contact for days. Tom then does a walk-off after a silly joke, and Susan congratulates Lynette on Tom's rocking bod and large dong.
Yeah.
Tom overhears this from the other room, huge smile on his face,
obviously.
And Susan asks why she never mentioned this, as they all assumed that Tom had a small one. But Lynette says that she really doesn't care what anyone thinks about that.
This scene does have the best line of the episode, possibly even of this season.
Okay.
No, I think that still goes to Beth when she yells, son of a bitch. But it's when Lynette goes, what do I care if people think he's got a dingy one?
Yeah. And she's so sincere about it. She really does feel that way.
Yeah.
She really is just happy enough without having to brag about it.
She doesn't need to brag about it. She's got her man and his donkey dick. She don't need nobody else knowing about it.
And Doug Savant probably loved the script.
Doug Savant, this is probably his favourite episode. Doug, I see what you're doing. You probably bribed the writers, didn't you, for this?
Mm. Later, Lynette asks what Tom wants for dinner, but he doesn't care as he just wants to know why Lynette doesn't talk to the ladies about his penis. God, that's a weird sentence. Lynette says that she doesn't care and wonders why he cares so much, and Tom makes a point of how all of the ladies talk about their men. Gabby talks about how rich Carlos is, Susan says that Mike is a badass, but how he is usually the butt of the joke, and this would be a victory for him. And you know what, I think this is actually quite a valid story for Tom.
Yeah, Tom's a lovely dad. We've seen him with the kids. He's great with the kids.
He's a big goofball.
He is. He's goofy. Like, the kids would love that when they're really young and, you know, they want to play and stuff like that. I reckon Tom was all over that with the kids when they were really young.
Mm. So Bob is with the ladies at Lynette's house to talk about Paul's master plan, which will be discussed more in Paul's story. Don't worry. It will be covered. And he assures them that it's unlikely that he can open up a halfway house as it needs approval from the homeowners association. So there'd need to be a vote. But anyway, how does this tie into Lynette's story, you ask? Karen wants to call now to deal with it, but Lynette worries that this is all a bit too easy for Paul as he's a smart guy. The ladies then say that they wish there was a more macho man here who could just scare him off, but sadly Mike is away. Karen then offers up Roy, and then Roy says that the gay.
This was
referring to Bob, by the way.
This was all funny jokes about how everyone is stronger and more intimidating than Tom until Roy ruined it with his casual, unintentional homophobia that Bob just laughed off. Like,
yeah, he just says maybe the gay could do some damage.
How about the gay? He looks like he could do some damage. Like, what the fuck, Roy?
But Bob, who really is a very clear homosexual, ignores the homophobia and takes the compliment.
Yeah, he's like, do you know what, bitch, I could do some damage. Bob's there like, oh, I got you, girl.
So Tom seems offended and he is just left serving everyone as Roy calls him a deer and asks him to grab some more cookies.
Be a deer, get some more cookies.
Lynette has an aside with Tom about this and they argue further about Tom feeling emasculated. So Lynette decides to tell the ladies about how big Tom is to hopefully settle this, and we have a clip.
Do, yes you do.
No, oh, you want me to talk you up?
Yeah, that
fine.
Would be great.
I'll talk you up. Listen, everybody, I've got an idea. If we need someone to intimidate Paul, Tom can do it in the men's room. Oh, you didn't hear? Tom's packing. We're talking big, circus big. So big he can drive in the carpool lane when he's alone.
Lynette.
If it falls in the forest, believe me, it makes a sound.
The Washington
Monument looks at it and says, I want to be you when I grow up.
Gee, you should think she'd smile more.
Circus big sounds painful.
Yeah, like this is going beyond complimentary and saying he's a freak.
Yeah.
And I don't mean a freak. I don't mean a freak in the sheets in a good way.
Lynette made this so much worse.
Yeah, she did.
By just humiliating him. She essentially just humiliated Tom right then.
In all fairness, he's making such a big deal about this, and Lynette's like, do you really think this is the issue right now?
Oh, yeah, I know. Lynette does make a valid point in, I think what she says in the next scene, in that was not the time nor the place to have that conversation. We'll get into that. But, I think Lynette just needs to learn to appreciate her husband's massive dick, or stop being so selfish and let him get with the size queen.
So, Lynette and Tom are alone, brushing their teeth, passive-aggressively, when they suddenly break out into a fight after Lynette double spits. Tom is annoyed as everyone thinks that he's a joke, but Lynette says that they all actually wish their husbands were more like him. Tom asks what Lynette is so annoyed about, and she says, how many people tell you that you have the perfect wife? She says they all think that she's so lucky, but they probably think that she's a big bitch who can never wait to get back to work after having kids. Tom tries to cheer her up and says how lucky he is to have such a funny and sexy wife and that she has a big heart and still cries whenever her kids are grown up. And it's all very sweet, and then they decide to have more sex.
How has Lynette made this about her?
That's exactly what I was thinking. I was like, Lynette, you have a very good point. I'm sure this is very upsetting, but how did you turn this around?
She literally changed Tom's entire viewpoint of the situation. Like, Tom went from, you don't brag about me to your friends and tell them I have a big dick, to, I need to brag about you more because you're great. Like,
yeah.
This bitch.
I mean, he just wants Lynette to talk nicely about him.
Yeah.
This was the resolution to a different story.
Yeah.
I think the important thing that should have been noted in this story is that people bitch and vent about their partners, but you have to say nice things too.
Yes.
You know? So let's move on to Gabby's story. Carmen has spoken to Hector and he is now staying with family in Mexico. Carmen says that they'll have to meet up with him and find a place to live and get jobs, and Gabby worries about Grace in all this and offers that she stay with her and Carlos until she figures this all out, but Carmen doesn't want this. They then have a little argument as Gabby thinks that it would be selfish of them to take Grace, and Carmen says that she doesn't want Grace to be spoiled and selfish like Juanita.
It really got personal. It always ends up back to Gabby's parenting skills as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, Carmen saw red.
Yeah, she really did. Like, just Gabby does have a point in that this isn't fair on Grace because she can't really spend her entire childhood running from one place to another. But it's difficult to agree with Gabby when Gabby's the one that's caused all of this and we know that she seems to have ulterior motives.
Yeah. So Gabby runs into Bob as he drives up from work, poor guy, to ask him for some legal advice. And she basically asks if it's legal for her to keep Grace if Carmen and Hector are deported. And Bob says it is legal, although morally questionable. She then goes inside on her own and pretty much instantly calls immigration.
Bob is very correct. Just because something is legal doesn't make it right.
Yeah. Now, this was a bit crazy, wasn't it? A bit of a villain arc.
Well, to throw Carmen to immigration when she's trusted you to keep her safe under your roof is, I think, the worst thing that Gabby has ever done in this show. And it might even be the worst thing that anyone has ever done on this show. And if someone has something they believe beats this, then write in. We would like to hear it. Obviously, I know
up
Lynette,
to this point.
Lynette pretending that Parker had cancer so she could go do yoga is also up there.
In all fairness, with that one,
don't justify it.
She didn't deny that he didn't have cancer, you know?
She shaved his head, bitch.
But anyway, it's funny how many times we say, this is the worst thing that anyone's done.
I know,
but this is really bad.
This is such an awful thing. Like, honestly, I just don't... Oh, God, it's horrible.
So Gappy is doing some cleaning while Grace is reading, and then out of the window, she sees that ice has shown up.
It's very messy, girl. And Gabby, don't think you're forgiven just because of what happens next.
Mm. Carmen sees this and panics. Gabby hugs Grace and says that everything's going to be okay, but she just wants to hug her mum, and so she runs off to Carmen. Carmen then asks Gabby to take care of Grace, but Gabby, clearly feeling mighty guilty right now after Grace ran off to Carmen, says that she isn't going anywhere and hatches a little plan. Oh. Carmen, pretending to be Gabby, then answers the door to the immigration officers, who asks where Carmen is. Gabby then walks out doing her best Latina cleaning lady impression, and it's just awful, and we can assume that they take her instead.
It's like a Mexican babushka lady. She was like covered in shawls or something, and she looked like those cliche babushka ladies.
Yeah, it's like she's doing an impression of that housekeeper lady from Family Guy, who is a bad impression of housekeepers.
Yeah, it's like a really terrible impression. But it's a sad moment. This is a very sad scene for various reasons. Like, it's sad seeing Grace run to Carmen instead of staying with Gabby, and it's sad to see Gabby's realization that just because she's Grace's biological mother doesn't mean that Grace sees her that way.
Yeah, she doesn't see her as her mother.
Yeah,
because she has a mother.
And then seeing Carmen's desire to do what she has to protect her daughter.
So Gabby is sitting in some sort of prison-like room with a bunch of people talking about their sad stories and how they came to the US, with the most recent being a man whose entire village died of cholera, and so he came over with his family. Gabby then asks if any of them have a happy story about coming to the US before an officer comes in and says that Carlos is here to pick her up.
No.
I don't think she has a clue.
No, I don't know, girl.
So she says good luck to everyone and leaves.
I'm sure I'll see you all again. You seem like a very persistent lad.
Yeah. Carlos says that Gabby was so brave for doing this and proud of her, and tells her that Carmen is in a hotel and that they'll be leaving for Texas in the morning, and that their house isn't safe for them anymore. So the consequences of Gabby's actions and everything that she was trying to avoid with that selfish phone call are catching up to her.
Yeah, and seriously, Gabby, like, you didn't realise that your place won't be being watched by the government now?
She was trying to avoid losing Grace by doing these things, and
it's done the exact opposite.
Yeah.
And it's so sad, because we can see she isn't in the right frame of mind, so it's tough to be too hard on her.
But it's also sad for Carmen, Hector and Grace, because this is happening to them and their whole lives have been turned upside down now.
Just because of Gabby's selfishness, yeah.
So Gabby and Carlos are saying goodbye to Carmen, Hector and Grace, and this must be very confusing for Grace, because she knows they have to go, that her parents have been through all this with her, but she has no idea why Gabby is going to be missing her so much and, like, wants to memorize her face and being so affectionate.
Well, yeah, because they've not really known each other for that long in the grand scheme of things.
So they put Grace in the car, and Carmen apologizes for previously calling Juanita selfish, but Gabby tells her not to worry about it and thanks her for taking such good care of Grace, and Carmen thanks Gabby for taking such good care of Juanita. Grace then waves goodbye to Gabby as the car drives off and Gabby breaks down in Carlos's arms.
It broke me. I was doing so well until Gabby and Carmen thanked each other.
Yeah.
And then I broke. Like, I was holding on for that scene, and then that's what broke me, when Gabby basically just went, thank you for taking care of my daughter. And then Carmen said the same thing. And as mothers, they kind of just pushed aside everything that they'd said to each other in the past that might have been antagonistic or mean, and just kind of forgave it and loved each other for taking care of each other's child.
Yeah. So we've already seen quite a turn in Gabby's mental space.
Yeah.
And some very questionable actions, but this is just the beginning.
It's heartbreaking to watch Gabby lose yet another daughter in the show. Even if this one is a daughter that wears a cardigan like that. But she's lost so many children. And so this is just another one down. And every single time we've seen it break Gabby a little bit more, and this just feels like it's the final straw.
Yeah, the writers are almost enjoying it at this point.
They're sadistic. They hate Gabby. The writers hate her.
Let's bring her down a peg or two. This is what they do whenever they feel like the women are being, they've done too much wrong.
Fucking Eva Longoria, get a god.
like with Brie, they were like, let's bring her down a peg.
Yeah.
Fucking conservative bitch, like, have some wine. And now we move on to the final story, which is Paul's. So Paul is buying a house on the neighborhood from an old man, but the man seems skeptical about it, even though Paul is asking for way above asking price.
Another one.
Yeah,
another one. House.
He's getting quite the monopoly. Paul tells him that he should leave the lane while he still remembers it, which is a bit rude, and before the lane changes. Now, this wording, before it all changes, concerns the man, but Paul just tells him not to worry and gets the house.
It's just, if someone comes to me, offers me well above market value for my house, and then tells me the neighbourhood is changing, that's major alarm bells.
Yeah. So he walks out to find Lee, who is late, and he lets it slip that he can now begin his plan. He then says that he can start letting everyone know, and he puts a sign up in the front yard, but we don't see what the sign is yet.
To be honest, Lee's captured the attitude of estate agents to a T. No offence to any estate agents out there. It's just, I work with them on a very regular basis in my job. I see them day in, day out. I know what y'all are like. And Lee is so obsessed with getting his commission that he doesn't even care what he's seeing. Like, he's not questioning it at all.
Karen and Roy are walking down the lane and talking about this big plaster on his head, which was from them trying out positions in the Kama Sutra. And Karen tells him to just say that he fell out of bed as they're old and people expect that sort of thing from them.
Yeah, but you'll just make people uncomfortable if you tell them you were doing the Kama Sutra.
Yeah. They then see the sign that Paul put up earlier, and Karen says that she's going to let everyone know about it. The camera does a little pan, and we can see that the sign says, Second Changes, Community Correctional Centre, coming soon.
A halfway house.
Yeah, it's a halfway house.
Mm-hmm.
Also, what has this Karen and Roy story got to do with anything? It doesn't go anywhere. Is it just meant to be funny because they're old?
It's just meant to be funny because they're old. They're supposed to be like randy little old people, aren't they?
Yeah. So Karen has managed to gather Lynette and Brie to see the sign, and she says it is transitional housing for felons under house arrest, which they all seem horrified by. Paul then comes out to own this and says how blessed he felt coming home from prison to such supportive neighbours. Lynette worries about children, Karen worries about spending her golden years with drug abusers and rapists, and Brie just says that she's all for charity, but this wouldn't work here, which I think was, even though there's one about children, probably the actual most Tory response.
The most, well, that's the thing, like, Paul's plan is kind of genius in that it hits them in their assets.
Yeah, it does.
So the minute this goes up, their property values will drop.
And we are middle-class conservative white Americans, we can't have that. So Paul just says that he has faith in them and that this will be his way of letting them know how he feels. Now, I do find everyone's reactions extremely concerning.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know that your property values are going down, but...
And that's...
None of you have hearts.
That's it. Like, as much as these ladies claim it's about the children, it's all about their money.
Yeah, it's just such a shame, the attitudes towards ex-convicts and felons and just... Especially when you've had Mike and Orson living on this lane.
Yeah.
For such a long time.
That's true. Because they fit in. Those husbands fit in to the mould of Wisteria Lane.
Yeah.
So it's fine to have them on the lane because they fit with the whole ethos of what Wisteria Lane is supposed to be. They fit in with the demographic of the lane. So it's perfectly fine to have them. Mike and Orson are respectable people.
So Bob is with all the ladies at Lynette's house, as discussed previously in Lynette's story, and he assures them that it's unlikely that Paul can open the halfway house as it would need approval from the homeowners association, so there'd need to be a vote. Karen wants to vote now to just deal with it, but Lynette worries that this is all a bit too easy for Paul as he's a smart guy.
Mm.
So the neighbourhood are all together in Lynette's place to vote on the halfway house, and everyone votes no except for Paul. Paul then steps in to note that the bylaws say that you have to have a 48-hour notice period for such things. They all say that their vote will be the same in 48 hours, but Paul informs them that because he owns 7 houses on the lane after buying that house in the morning, he actually has 7 votes.
7 houses?
Yeah.
7 houses?
Just by putting up his hand, his one hand, that's 7 votes. So everyone turns on Lee for a second, as he was Paul's real estate agent, which isn't fair, I have to say. Before Paul says that he only needs 1 more vote. He then says if anyone else sells the house, then he will win this. Carlos says that he can't scare them, but Paul makes a very valid point. Carlos is rich, so he can just move on when property values go down. But someone like Mrs. Kinski, for example, has just been laid off and isn't quite as lucky. And he tells her that he could offer her way above market value for her place, and she looks quite tempted.
How big was his settlement from the government?
Yeah.
And he can buy 7 houses on this lane.
How rich was he before that in the first place as well?
I'm not Sure.
I wonder. But either way, it's impressive. He also says that he can buy Karen and Susan's houses before they lose their value, especially since all of Karen's savings are probably tied up in the house, which is true. So this is some dirty tactics, but it's working.
It's very good.
Yeah, so Kinski worries about losing her opportunity if someone else sells before her, which is hilarious. And Karen and Roy have a private whispering conversation too, which leads to everyone arguing, including people arguing about Lee again.
Well...
So... Some saying that they have to stick together and that this is what Paul is trying to do, with others turning on Lee for selling so many houses. But, like, the dude's just doing his job.
Yes, but to a certain extent, we go back to what we said a little bit earlier, in that he's not thinking. Just doing his job. He's getting his commission. That's all he seems to care about. He's not thinking, is it not a bit odd that I'm selling 7 houses on the same lane to this one guy? There's nothing Lee could have done about it.
Yeah, in all fairness, is there much point in questioning it? Like, because couldn't he just go with anyone else if Lee, for whatever reason, just said no?
Yeah. So ultimately, there's nothing Lee could have done about it. If Paul wants to buy these houses, Paul's going to buy these houses. But essentially, people are going to naturally start to have a problem with Lee, who was the one that was involved in all of this.
Mm-hmm. So Lynette tries to calm them all down without any luck and tells Paul that they won't let him destroy the street. Paul then says he won't have to, as they're all going to do it themselves.
All Paul has to say is, all I really need is one more house. And then everyone's like, oh, it's going to be you. It's going to be you.
Well, he's got a good point because, yeah, he says, I just need one more. Everyone loses their friggin' minds. But he's like, half of these people are in very different situations to the other half. So even if they did sell the houses, it's like, well, you can't really blame them.
No, you can't. Like, Kinski, she's not a very nice person. We've seen her previously. She's an arsehole.
She doesn't even have to be laid off.
Right? She's a money grubber. But she's just been laid off. So this is her only asset. If this halfway house opens and it affects her property pricing and she has to move to a more affordable neighborhood, that's affected how much money she's going to get right there in that one move.
Yeah, that might like make her more comfortable for a long time.
Yeah.
And that is where the episode ends.
Mm-hmm.
That was the end.
The end. Everyone's now tearing each other to shreds to try and figure out who the traitor is.
So let's move on to the next part of the episode where Joel's going to give the gayest and the straightest moment. So what do you have for the gayest moment of the episode?
My award for gayest moment, I'm going to give it to Renee for crying on her birthday and listening to herself.
Yeah.
Because I think that's very... Gays can be very narcissistic. And what's more narcissistic than listening to your own singing?
It's hilariously gay, isn't it? It is. It's perfect.
Gays hate aging and we love the sound of our own voice.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I think every gay thinks they can sing as well.
Every gay thinks they can sing, but not every gay can.
That is correct. And then what do you have for straightest moment?
My award for straightest moment. It goes to Roy and Tom.
Okay.
It goes to Roy for that homophobia. How about the gay? He looks like he could do some damage.
Yeah.
And it goes to Tom for kind of going along with it by being insulted by the fact that everyone thinks that Bob is stronger than him. And that's like an insult.
Yeah, I feel like he was really bothered by the old man and the lack of his name, but then the gay. Oh my God.
Yeah, I know. It was like Roy, Bob.
My wife.
Like, oh my God. It's like, yeah. Oh no, everyone's stronger than me. Wow.
Yeah.
So now we move on to B's awards for best and worst parent. So who do you have for the best parent?
My award for
best parent of the episode.
I'm giving this to Carmen for taking such good care of Grace, as Gabby says.
Well done, Carmen. Yeah, that's a good one. Carmen did do a good job.
Yeah, Carmen did do a good job. And also, there wasn't really anyone else I could give it to. In this entire episode.
No, not really. There was very little parenting this episode, to be fair.
There was other parenting, and it was all just the worst.
Mm.
So.
So, okay. Who do you have for the worst, then?
So, my award for...
worst parent of the episode.
Now, I could give this to Keith's dad for hitting on Bree, but really, I think I should give it to Gabby, because her selfish, immoral actions have actually led to Grace having to move very far away.
Oh, God, yeah. Grace has had to uproot her whole life now because of Gabby.
Yeah, and it wasn't just a selfish action, but it was devious.
Of course it was devious. And yes, we know, like, Gabby's obviously going through a hard time mentally, and this has really pushed her through it, but it was still bad parenting.
Yeah, she almost got her daughter's parents arrested. What a weird sentence.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So those are my awards. So bravo, bravo, fucking bravo to everyone for all of their awards for gayest, straightest, best and worst parents, all of that jazz.
Woo.
So that was the end of the episode. That was season 7, episode 9, Pleasant Little Kingdom. If anyone has any questions, queries, comments and theories, where can they find us?
You can find us on Instagram at boyfriendsreview.
We also have email, which is boyfriendsreview@outlook.com, and all of the artwork is done by Louis, who you can find on Instagram at docredmonkdesign, and there's a link to his Etsy page where he does commissions.
Yes.
Join us next time when we'll be back in your ear holes with season 7, episode 10, Down the Block, There's a Riot.
The disaster episode.
Yes, the disaster episode.
Mm.
It's been ages since we did one of these. See you then.
Bye, guys.
Bye.